Okay, good evening, everyone. We begin our discussion about America after spending 5 months discussing Europe. There was a school of thought about the history of American Judaism that said that Reform Judaism came to America as the product of European civilization imported to the United States by intellectual figures who went across the Atlantic at some point in the mid-19th century. So if that school of thought was correct in its understanding of the situation, then we'd be right to discuss Europe first and America second, you know, in that order. That the Germans figured out heterodoxy, they came to all sorts of intellectual conclusions about what should be Jewish belief and what should be Jewish practice, and they brought it over to the United States, where it flourished. That school of thought is presented, for example, in the 1907 book by David Philipson, The Reform Movement in Judaism, which was, in its time, the classic work on the origins of non-orthodoxy. But, over time, that viewpoint was rejected, most emphatically by a book put out in the 1970s by Professor Leon Jick, titled The Americanization of the Synagogue. It's one of the most important books in the writing of American Jewish history, in which he notes that Reform Judaism in America was not borrowed from another continent. It was a peculiar American invention, having little or nothing to do with thinkers who came from Europe. That yes, there were rabbis who came in the 1840s, 1850s, 1860s with strong opinions, who had made careers for themselves in Europe, or some of them actually did, and some of them were starting afresh in America, but there were those who were important figures in Europe who came to the United States and led in prestigious congregations. However, what Jick notes is that those rabbis had little or no influence on the direction of denominational life in this country. They were servants. They were not leaders. That's an important distinction. They were servants. They worked for their congregations who bossed them around and who told them what to do, and the lay leadership would determine the fate of Judaism in any given community. Now, what then led to the Reform Movement? Simply this: the Americanization of Judaism. A desire to have a style of religion that fits in this country, as opposed to old world ghetto orthodoxy, which has no place in the United States. Of course, in 2018, it's hard to say that, but in 1860, it was very easy to say that. Now, if it's the case that the emergence of Reform Judaism, or for that matter, any denomination of Judaism in America, was peculiar to the American experience, we have to know what factors differed here as opposed to there. Why is religious life different in America as opposed to in Central Europe? And so we can point to about four or five factors that are extremely polar opposite on the two sides of the Atlantic. The first one is government intervention, or government interest in the fate of religion, specifically Judaism. In Europe, where there is no separation of church and state, in fact, the church is very much entrenched in the state, to a greater or lesser extent depending upon the decade and the country, but still, there is an ecclesiastical hierarchy that is part of the state bureaucracy, and there often is an official religion. So the state has an interest in the fate of Judaism, usually to undermine Judaism in the long run, and to see people convert to Christianity. Over time, that proselytizing interest goes away, but still there's an interest in Judaism because the religious community does certain functions that the modern state really should do, but passes off to the religious community, like the registration of births and deaths and marriages and divorces and the like, or just basic demographic work that today we're accustomed to a Census Bureau doing, or various departments of state government. Back then, the religious community was still operating in that capacity. So, in Europe you have all these things, in America you have none of it. In America, you have a relationship between the individual citizen and their government, not between a group of the people of a certain confession, namely Judaism, and the government. The individual citizen relates to his own government, not the kehila. Tremendous, tremendous difference between Europe and the United States. Now, that's not to say that there is absolute separation between church and state in America. That's not the case. Okay, the Constitution doesn't say much about religion. The Bill of Rights, which amends the initially composed Constitution, does have a clause preventing the establishment of religion at the federal level and preventing the free exercise, at least as far as the federal government is concerned. But what about at the state level? At the state level, you can still have religious bias codified in the law. And so some states didn't have that. By the time of the American Revolution, New York was perfectly in the clear on that front. But other states not. For example, Maryland. Maryland had a Jew bill in 1826 to finally get rid of all the last restrictions on the Jews holding public office.
For the state house.
For the state house, yeah.
Oh, it's in the state house. Yeah, yeah. The Jew bill,
I've seen it. So, but they were not the last ones. New Hampshire was the last one in 1876, which is a very late in the game. It's 100 years after the Declaration of Independence. And truth be told, the Supreme Court did not rule that the Bill of Rights and the Establishment Clause, Free Exercise Clause, and all the clauses of the First Amendment applied to the state governments until 1940. I forget the name of the case, but it wasn't until 1940 that all aspects of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights apply at the state level. So, yes, America has its issues, but it's resolving those issues. The point is, Europe is very different on the matter of government interference. The second point. In Europe, you have a long-standing tradition of piety and minhag that cannot be easily overturned at the local level, as opposed to the United States, where there is no minhag, because there is no tradition since we just got here 5 seconds ago. And you're not going to have to overturn long-standing minhagim, gzeirot, takanot, whatever it might be. There is no long record of this kihila operating in a certain way. And in the absence of such a long-standing history, you're free to do whatever you want, assuming you can get a few other people to agree with you.
That assumes that the people who came to the United States did not bring with them any minhagim.
They did, but we're going to see they're individuals, and they're individuals of low religious standing, very low religious standing, in terms of personal observance and, more importantly, knowledge, because you need knowledge to perpetuate a tradition, and whether book knowledge or even just practical knowledge, and it's very much lacking.
Okay. Practices
from the early days. So, in a few minutes, we're going to get to that point on the issue of ethnicity of Sephardi versus Ashkenazi and the extent to which they were observant. We'll get to that.
Didn't they have, where there were many Jews, they have separate congregations from this, you know, different brands of Jews?
So, we're going to discuss the origins of the second and third congregations in New York after Sherith Israel. Why did a second and third congregation emerge? And then, for that matter, a fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh.
Well, first, because of the Ashkenaz component.
That's an important part of it, but it's not the only part. B'nai Jeshurun, yeah. So we have the issue of government interference. We have the issue of tradition, which existed there but doesn't exist here. Another important point, the rabbis. The rabbis are the gatekeepers of the tradition, and for that matter, the doctors of the law. In Europe, even in Central Europe, where the yeshivas had been on decline, and the rabbonim were fairly low standing compared to the gedolim of Eastern Europe, that's how the legend goes, still, at least you had rabbonim. In America, you don't. The first rabbi comes here in 1840, and even he finds little comfort in this country and almost no following and has a miserable existence. Abraham Rice in Baltimore.
He was really the only real rabbi.
The only real rabbi for a while. Yes. Now, the last consideration, which is a big difference between Europe and the United States, is that emancipation played a vital role in the trajectory of non-Orthodox Judaism, the emergence of Reform. The ideologues would like to downplay that and say, no, 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 Reform was an internal Jewish matter that developed over time and was well thought out theologically, but the God's honest truth is what? Reform went hand in hand with this desire for emancipation, and although there was almost never a quid pro quo of you get rid of this religious practice and we'll give you emancipation, it's not a quid pro quo, but the relationship is very, very close. That's not true in America. Why not? Because there's no struggle for emancipation. The Jews are free citizens, and yeah, there are minor distractions in certain states about not holding public office till after the revolution, but basically, emancipation is not a struggle. It's given. So if it's given, then what is the relationship of religion to one's citizenship? It doesn't really matter. So if it doesn't matter, you're free to do whatever you want, not feel compelled to reform, but for social reasons, you might find it a good thing to reform. And that's going to be the watchword in America. The social adaptation is what leads to changes in religious practice. Not because anyone was coercing it from the outside, the government didn't care, okay, and there was no rabbi at the top who was saying this is what God wants. No, none of that. It's because what the people want, since the people want to be good Americans, and this is what they think will be make them a better American.
What's the difference between the desire of emancipation,
yeah,
vis-a-vis assimilation,
yeah,
and being emancipated at the beginning and assimilating? It seems to be the same result on both ends.
You're right. It is the same result, but it does impact upon the timing and the possibility of linear progression versus fits and starts. In Europe, where the government has a viewpoint about Jewish religious reform, that if it's a conservative regime might be opposed to it, and if it's a liberal regime might favor it, so you can have progress followed by arrested progress, and maybe even a few steps backward, as was the case in Prussia, where things were outlawed. The Berlin Reform Congregation was put out of business for a while. So where the government is involved and emancipation is in play, you go a little bit, step back, a little bit, step back. When emancipation is not in play, it's just an issue of cultural adaptation. It's a one-way street. You're getting more and more American and less Jewish. There's no turning back. There's no Kiruv movement. There's no attempt at reviving lost rituals or lost, you know, aspects of Jewish identity. Doesn't exist.
What time period are you talking about?
So in America, we're talking about 1830s to the 1870s. Okay.
Just prior to the major East European immigration.
Yes. The Eastern European immigration begins in earnest in 1881 after the pogroms, after the assassination of Alexander the Second, and but to be honest, there was Eastern European immigration before that from Romania in the 1870s and from Lithuania because of economic conditions and famine. But even before 1870, there were some Eastern European Jews in the United States, mostly Polish Jews, but Polish Jews who came from Posen, which is really Germany in the political sense. So these are Minhag Polin, but administratively were from a Central European country. All right, now let's get to what happens in the United States. Jews come to America 1654. In a small number, 23 Jews off the boat from Recife, Brazil, escaping the Inquisition. The basic idea in colonial times is that if you come from a Catholic country, then you're escaping what amounts to religious persecution. Likely, if you came from a Catholic country, it's because you're of Spanish or Portuguese extraction and have a history of being on the run since the Spanish expulsion in 1492. But if you can make it to a Protestant country, or you can make it to Amsterdam, then life is good. Or if you can make it to a territory in the New World, which is controlled by the Netherlands, then you're in good shape. So New Amsterdam in 1654 is a colony of the Dutch West India Company, and Peter Stuyvesant is in control. He doesn't like Jews. He's a something of a bigot, and wants the Jews out. They are not kicked out because Jewish investors in the stock company pressure the government back in Amsterdam to allow Jews to remain, and so they remain. There's a small kehillah, the founding of Sherith Israel as the first Jewish synagogue in the United States, is claimed to be from 1654, although they really didn't have a synagogue right away. The first synagogue building is constructed on Mill Street in 1730. Before that, they were in a house or in rented quarters. Okay, all the kehillot in the early days of colonial Jewry are Spanish-Portuguese in nature, Sephardic. Where are they located? In New York, in Newport, in Philadelphia, in Charleston, and in Savannah. Later there'd be one in Richmond, and as time went on, you'd have even in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, a small kehila. Eventually you'd have Boston, Baltimore, Reading, Washington, D.C. New Orleans would be around 1815, then St. Louis, Cincinnati in 1824, and a whole bunch of others after that. But okay, so in the first five, the original colonial era ones were all Sephardic, not Nusach Sephard of the Hasidim of Hungary, but legitimate Spanish Portuguese. How religious were these people? That's an important question. So anyone who went to America was likely not to be all that pious, because they were leaving behind their traditional community back home, whether in Europe or, for that matter, in the Caribbean. Certainly this was the case for any German Jews who came to America, that they were leaving behind their traditions and wanted, if at all possible, to preserve Jewish identity in the new world, but didn't necessarily know how to do it. Because if you don't have the book knowledge, How do you recreate certain functions of the kehillah? I mean, the most important one is a shochet. So there were shochtim. How competent were they? Did they know hilchas shechita? Dubious at best. There was always problems with the quality of the legitimacy of the shechita. What about mila? You need a moel. All right, you can have a surgeon do it. You need certain religious items, a shofar, a lulav. It's not always so easy to procure these things. Tefillin, mezuzah, sefer Torah. There were no sofrim in the New World. They had to bring things over from the Old World. So these are issues. How do you create a kehillah if the infrastructure and the professionals simply aren't there? Okay. Who leads the davening? Who's the baal tefillah? The answer is the person who could read Hebrew is the baal tefillah. Now this person becomes a member of the clergy. Whether this was good in the long run for Judaism or not, the baal tefillah became the so-called chazan, and the chazan became a minister. What was the role of the chazan / minister? So, in theory, it's just to lead the services, to recite the liturgy, read the Torah. But beginning with Gershom Mendesatius, who was the Chazan in Sherith Israel from 1778 until 1816, he introduced the idea that the Chazan is also a preacher. He's a minister of the Jewish religion, like a Protestant minister. Just as all the Protestant denominations have their clergymen, so we have our clergymen. The fact that he was not ordained by some school of divinity and has no real training in the Talmud or in the Rabbinic Judaism, doesn't matter. What matters is that he gets up there and gives a speech and davens for the Amud, and that makes him the Jewish minister. And he is deserving of respect. But is he really deserving of respect? What happens if he goes to the house of ill repute when he's off the job, or he's seen eating treif? That was a big problem. That the personal piety of the individual who was leading the davening and was the so-called minister, or the shochet, or whatever, oftentimes was a charlatan. He may have been, on his own time, dismissive of the halakha, and of dubious morality. So, it's embarrassing.
You could say that the whole congregation led that same type of life.
Yes, but there's an expectation that the minister would be a somewhat higher level than the average layman.
So who was in charge of the Besai Kiddushin and
Gittin? Ah, interesting. So the Seder Kiddushin was something that the ministers, the chazan / ministers, wanted for themselves because it was an opportunity for hachnasa, money. Correct. And when the real rabbis or the supposed rabbis actually came over from Europe, they wanted to intrude on the turf of the chazan minister, and sometimes the lay leadership, the parnasim, would not allow it. They would require explicit permission from the board for these new clergymen to officiate marriages, or as in the parlance of the time, to give kiddushin. There was the expression, to give kiddushin. Divorce, so there wasn't much divorce, but when it happened, you needed the authorization of a get by a sofer who knows what he's doing, which basically didn't exist. So I don't know if Gittin really were executed properly before the arrival of rabbis in the 1840s. What, in other words, make the best of a bad situation?
I mean, if that's the best you got.
You're talking 150 years.
Yes, we're talking a long time. 170 years, 190 years, but between the arrival of Jews and the first rabbi.
190
years? Yeah, 1654 to 1840.
Yeah, they were all dead by then.
You're not even talking about conversions.
No, forget, there were no conversions. There were no conversions.
So
there were mikvot, there were some mikvot, and they were not very hygienic, but they did exist. And it was the responsibility of the minister to oversee the quality of the ritual bath.
In the Caribbean, they had...
In the Caribbean, there were real rabbonim, and there was real shechita and real mikvah, there was real Judaism, but not on the continent. In the 13 colonies, you just didn't have much. Okay. Yes, okay, so the Spanish-Portuguese communities, especially that of Charleston, which we'll speak about shortly, would ask their questions to the rabbi of the Bevis Mark Synagogue in London. So the Sephardi Chacham was in a relationship with the Kihilot of the New World. And there were serious questions that were asked, including about slaveholding. Do you have to give a bris milah to your African slaves? Are they Avid Kanani? Do you have to give bris milah to the black slaves? Because, after all, a Jewish owner has an achrayas, has a responsibility in the halacha to make this slave of a Kanani. The answer was, you're supposed to.
Call a black man.
So,
not only that's
not to say that people adhered to this ruling, but that was theoretically the ruling. All right. Let's now go to...
In the Jewish Museum in Philadelphia,
uh-huh.
There was a kit, a circumcision kit.
Yeah, yeah.
From a southern gentleman.
Yeah. Gave bris to his slave population. Yeah. I don't doubt that it happened sometimes. But I know for sure that it didn't always happen. All right. So the Kihilot were Spanish Portuguese, but the population that went to shul wasn't all of that extraction. Many of them were European Ashkenazim from the Germanic states. Why then was the Kihila still Spanish Portuguese? Because, and this is an important point when it comes to American Judaism, the existing community represents the earlier wave of immigration that has acculturated and has risen through the ranks economically so that it can support a house of worship. And so anyone who arrives after that and is of different extraction has to make their peace with the style of Kihila that already exists until such time as you have enough of your variety of Jew that you can say, good riddance, breakaway, and we'll have our own Kihila that suits our fancy. But that doesn't happen during the colonial period. No. Everyone has to make their peace with the Spanish-Portuguese style of davening. Okay, so in what community do you have the first breakaway? Answer, Philadelphia. Philadelphia was the first city where there was a second shul. That you have Mikveh Israel, which was Spanish-Portuguese, and in 1795, enough Germanic Jews are dissatisfied with the Kihila that they break away and form Rodev Shalom, which is incorporated, I think, in 1802. So the late 1790s, early 1800s, you have stirrings of rebellion. 1802, you have the congregation is incorporated. This kehila, I believe, still exists to this day. And
Rod of
Shalom. Yeah. I'm not sure. It's not. It's Mikveh Israel. I've been to. I've never been to Rod of Shalom.
Mikveh Israel is a new building.
Right. It's yeah. So Rod of Shalom establishes itself as a kehila. It's an Orthodox one to begin with, as all the kehilot are. There is no stirring of reform yet. However, over time, Rod of Shalom would become a middle-of-the-road synagogue under the leadership of none other than Marcus Jastrow. Anyone who studied Talmud in the United States knows good old Marcus Jastrow, the author of the dictionary. So he is a tamed reform rabbi in that he's not a radical. But his synagogue would eventually go full-fledged reform. And that goes to show you that over time, a synagogue can make a transformation. You don't have to begin the shul as an ideologically reformed synagogue. It can evolve. In the case of Rod of Shalom, it took a long time.
That goes for what happened in New York. I think the first reformed synagogue that was formed as a reformed synagogue was Temple Emanuel.
Was Emanuel, yes.
It was on the Lower East Side of Clinton Street.
So, Rod of Shalom is a German kehila. Mikveh Israel, Spanish Portuguese, do they get along? The answer is that on religious issues, there are problems in the beginning of the different minhagim. But in terms of their relationship to the outside world, in theory, there should be no problem. There should be a united Jewish front. And yet there isn't. Because the uppity Spanish-Portuguese intelligentsia and elite aristocracy want nothing to do with the newcomers, even if the newcomers obtain a degree of wealth, and so that they are not asking for a handout, this is not a charity case, this is a German kehila that has money. Still, it doesn't matter. The cultural differences are not just in matters of nusach tefillah, but also just more broadly. People think of themselves as elite, and others are beneath our dignity. Possibly, but most Jews did not educate themselves secularly. They were involved in commercial activity, and they were not noted for the white collar professions early on. Okay, so the second place that had a breakaway was Charleston. And that's what we'll discuss now. Charleston had 600 Jews in 1824. Its only house of worship was Congregation Beit Elohim. And it was a traditional Spanish-Portuguese synagogue that conducted the ritual as all the other ones did. The board of Parnassim, the Ma'amad, conducted its affairs in Portuguese, except no one understood Portuguese. So they were veering off towards English. But just for old time's sake, there was an element of the old language. We'll see this as a common theme in the 19th century. The minutes, the recording of the minutes. German kehilot also would hold on to German much longer than they really needed to.
Oh, just like the old shuls on the Lower East Side, did it in Yiddish?
Hold on to Yiddish, yeah. The even though no one spoke Yiddish, they did hold on to it. Okay, so the synagogue service was unsatisfactory to a certain percentage of the membership. And in 1824, 47 members signed a petition requesting certain changes, improvements. These were not of an ideological variety, but rather mostly about decorum and the length of service and aesthetics, and improvement of understanding, comprehension.
That sounds like what you talked about in Europe.
Yes, sure, absolutely. Same sort of thing. So what kind of changes do we have in mind? First of all, the abridging of the service overall. That's one important point. It's too long. Next point, we don't understand what's being said. Therefore, the more important prayers should be rendered both in the Hebrew and in the English. Also, the Torah reading is not in any way instructional or edifying. It's just gibberish. So, therefore, someone should get up and give a homily, give an exposition of some passage within the weekly Torah reading so as to make the Torah reading relevant. That Parshat HaShavua, just out of the scroll, is meaningless to us, but Parshat HaShavua in a sermon, in a lecture, is significant. We could learn something. All right? Decorum. People are disrespecting the service by talking during the prayers. And moreover, the prayers are interrupted by calls for order. So not only is the talker causing trouble, but the gabbai who's asking people to be quiet is causing trouble because he has to talk himself. So it's like a no-win. Therefore, we have to change this. Something has to be done. And there needs to be better decorum, aside from talking, in the synagogue service. People need to comport themselves in a dignified manner, whether it's in terms of dress or in any way. It shouldn't be a disgrace for an outsider to walk into our service and look and see this is not a house of God. Okay, so these are some of the requests. Nothing was especially terrible from a halachic point of view, but the requests were rejected summarily by the board. Why? Because people in power don't like to be told what to do. People in power want to have absolute control and not listen to the wishes and desires of others.
Because the ethnic makeup of the complainants and the board...
The same. There's a little bit of an ethnic issue in that the leadership was dominated by Spanish Portuguese Jews, and the complainers may have had a greater percentage of German/Polish, mostly German. So there's a slight ethnic angle of newcomer versus the old aristocracy, but basically it's just there's a problem in this shul, we don't understand what's going on, make it better. Rejected.
Was there no religious education at all at that time?
Almost none. It's an ongoing problem in America in the colonial period in the 19th century, how to educate your children Judaically. The ideal would be a day school. But day schools... So there were some day schools, but they usually failed after a short period of time because of poor quality of education, insufficient number of pupils, and more importantly, insufficient number of teachers who knew what to teach. Yeah. So the Sunday school movement, which is started by Rebecca Gratz in Philadelphia in 1838, is the opposite. You know, you have day school versus Sunday school, but both are problematic. The day school because you can't sustain it, and the Sunday school because kids don't learn anything. It's a very limited instruction. So what you end up with is the supplemental education of the Talmud Torah, which in the early period hardly exists. In the Eastern European period, becomes standard practice after public school, going to the cheder. Yeah. I once met a Jew from New Orleans who was an eighth generation American Jew whose great great grandfather fought in the Confederacy, and he was a Frumma Yid, and he used to come daven in the Shacharis Minyan at Park East when he was visiting someone in Sloan Kettering. But he, by his own admission, says he's the only Jew of the sort. Oh yeah? Could be.
So in Charleston, they go back generations. The same families that were there.
Right.
Almost to the Civil War.
Yeah, yeah.
And they came originally from the Caribbean.
So there are some, but very, very few. Very, very few. Precious few. For example, Sheriff Israel in New York has no members that date back, you know, to colonial times. It's not a Spanish Portuguese shul anymore, other than in name only and in rite and in ritual, but not by virtue of its congregants. So this request is rejected, and the complainers decide to do something about it. They establish the Reformed Society of Israelites. Reformed Society of Israelites. Now notice it's a society. What's the difference in a society and a congregation? Which one is more all-encompassing?
A society is
A society, correct. So the goal here was to say, we're more than just a shul. We're not a breakaway shul. We are much more than that. We want to create a brand, a style of Judaism and Jewish living that is better than what Beit Elohim has to offer, because it's reformed. Do they know about the reform going on in Europe? In 1824, what reform was going on in Europe? So recall what we discussed in September and October. What was happening in 1824?
It was in between.
The Seisson Temple was 1810. That was out of business. Israel Jacobson went to Berlin, and he established the Berlin Congregation in the home of the Beer family. And it was shut down by the Prussian government in 1823. So it doesn't exist anymore. It had about an 8-year run and then was shut down because the Prussian government was against any and all reforms. The Hamburg Temple was established in 1818 and led to a whole machlokes between the Orthodox rabbis, led by Chassam Sofer and the others, against the handful of reform rabbinical type figures like Eliezer Lieberman and Aaron Korn of Arad. So that was a big machlokes in 1818-1819, and it continued to exist. But very limited, just Berlin and Hamburg, and maybe at the Leipzig Fair there was a reform temple, but there wasn't much reform going on in Europe. Yet, the fellows in Charleston say, we heard about reforms going on in Europe. They heard something about the Hamburg temple. They were not inspired by it. If anything, it was like a throwaway line. We're not the only ones doing this. We heard there's something going on in Europe too. So it's not as though we are the first and only upstarts against tradition.
Weren't they German? Most of the ones that...
But they had come to America before.
Sure, they must have known what was going on.
They had limited knowledge of what's going on. They knew, but limited knowledge. Yeah.
Is the definition of reform, whatever that may be,
yeah,
is that the same along the lines of the European definition of reform?
There are no definitions yet because this is a brand new subject.
So reform is reform. We're reforming from the break, from what?
From what was.
Okay.
Reform was more of a verb than an adjective in this case?
Right. In this instance...
An adjective.
Reformed society, it's an adjective. It's not a proper noun yet.
Yeah.
Okay. So what do they do? Not proper. What do they do? They put forth a creed. This was not only a matter of tinkering with the service. They'll have it. They'll have their own synagogue with services, but they also establish a creed, and it departs from the Maimonidean 13 principles in 4 noticeable ways. 1, resurrection of the dead is replaced with the immortality of the soul. All right, nicht gefährlich. You know, a lot of people replaced the resurrection of the dead with the immortality of the soul, and it's a modern concept.
They live to tell about it.
Yeah. The second point.
This time around.
The revelation of God's will, which according to the Maimonidean creed encompasses the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, is dumbed down by this group to include only what? No. The Ten Commandments. The Decalogue. The Ten Commandments. The third point, there is a chidush, a novelty, a Judaic requirement of goodwill towards all of mankind. So, goodwill towards all of mankind. In other words, we are not parochial, and we are not xenophobic and misanthropic, but rather we love all people. Good Reform Judaism, love all people. No. The Torah says, V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. L'reacha means your fellow Israelite. Am shi'itcha b'torah v'mitzvot. To say goodwill towards all of mankind is a nice thing, but it's not the tradition. Okay, and the fourth point, why am I forgetting what it was? The fourth point was, it'll come to me. There was one more departure from the tradition. Huh? The Messiah, correct. The Messiah, the Redeemer, not the Messiah, the Redeemer,
same difference.
The Redeemer is God Himself. Now, what does that mean?
Keep it to the voice.
So, this is a rejection of the personal Messiah of Rabbinic Judaism, but it's also a rejection of Christianity. So, it's it's a safe play in the sense that it's a departure from tradition, but because it is a rejection of Christianity, it looks like a good expression of Jewish pride. Jewish pride. You know, we're not them. All right. They had a synagogue service. What was it like? Well, the conduct of the service was mostly in Hebrew, but a healthy dose of English. There was a sermon, and there was musical accompaniment. There was a prayer book, yes. Now, that's important, because this prayer book emerges well before the Hamburg Temple had a prayer book. So it's actually one of the earliest examples of a Reformed liturgy.
Printed here?
Printed here in Charleston, yes. Which predates Minhag America by Wise and Alua Tamid by Einhorn by 30 years. But nobody used it other than the Charleston congregation.
Is it extant today? Do we have copies of it?
Yes.
They have it there.
They have it there, and it's in the library at JTS. Okay, so this prayer book made no reference to Hanukkah and Purim, interestingly. Post-biblical holidays, which is an interesting point. Yeah. Yes, Hebrew and English, and we. But the problem is, we don't know the extent to which they actually followed it in the conduct of their services. This is a general problem. When you study liturgy, and you have a physical book in front of you, all you see is the physical book, but you don't know what they really did. And I mean, after all, we have Art Scroll prayer books or Koran prayer books on the shelf over here. Did you read every last page of that prayer book? No. So if 1,000 years from now, aliens came down and wanted to know what they do in Young Israel and Woodmere, they don't know what they did in Young Israel and Woodmere. They just know what the book says. So we have the book, but
we don't know what we're doing here.
Okay. Now, this Society of Reformers was led by a man by the name of Isaac Harby. He was a playwright, an editor, a man about town, would be intellectual. And he died at a fairly young age. He died at the age of 40 in 1828, not long after this society was formed. But he was the one who really got the ball rolling. And he said that we want to pray with devotion to God and not be bound by a priestcraft or the rules of antiquity. In other words, let not the evils of Talmudic Judaism interfere with our communion with God. Let it be the way we want it to be, and not be the way we're told by our immediate predecessors who were following Talmudic Judaism. Where is this coming from, this anti-Talmudism? Where is it coming from? Okay, so some say, Yesh Omrim, that Spanish-Portuguese Judaism in the United States or elsewhere suffers from the fact that such Jews had to be underground for a while as Muranos, and even when they recovered their Judaism in Amsterdam and in various places in Western Europe, they never fully recovered a sincere appreciation of Talmudic Rabbinic Judaism, but rather it was more of a biblical Judaism. And so their connection to strict halacha was tenuous at best, and with the opportunity to reform Judaism, reform Rabbinic Judaism, and to restore something pristine, the goal is some sort of a biblical religion that they claim they are bringing back. This is, some scholars make this assertion that Spanish-Portuguese Judaism never really had an affinity for true Rabbinic Judaism. I tend to think this is true, actually. I accept this theory. No, of course not.
A physical Talmud?
No, absolutely not.
The first Talmud that made it to these Jews?
They wouldn't understand it. I'm guessing, but I'm going to guess emphatically that there was no full copy of the Shas in the United States in the colonial period. Who was reading it? Unless some collector had one, and I don't think that would even be the case. Okay? So, this Society of Reformed Israelites is popular for a time. It at one point had over 200 members. Well, 50 family units, 200 people, which was about 40% the size of about 60% the size of the parent congregation of Beit Elohim. So they did attract a substantial following, but it fizzled out. And by 1833, it didn't exist anymore. And the reason is not because people turned against Reform Judaism, far from it. No, it's that there were demographic and economic factors that hurt Charleston. There was a downturn economically in 1828. Some of the leading lights moved out of town to Philadelphia and to New York. And Isaac Harvey died. There was basically a dwindling of the Kehillah as a whole, to the point that people didn't want to pay for and sustain a separatist organization.
I don't know if they even had a physical building.
They did not. They had rented space. So what happened to the members of the Reform Society of Israelites when it ceased to function? They went in one of two ways. Either they went back to the parent body, the Beit Elohim Synagogue, which was still holding on as a traditional house of worship, or they ceased being involved in Judaism altogether, which is an important thing to remember whenever we discuss the fate of a Reform Kehillah. When something no longer exists, don't assume it is replaced by something else, because oftentimes it isn't. It dissipates, and the religious connection of those who had been involved might simply be non-existent. That is the fate of much of American Jewry. Okay, so, in 1836, Beit Elohim is looking for a chazan, and they hire Gustavus Poznanski. Now, with a name like Gustavus Poznanski, where is he from?
Germany.
Posen, of course. So he's a Polish Jew from Germany. So where does he come from? Well, he had been in Europe, and in the 1820s, he spent some time in Hamburg. So he was familiar with the existence of the Hamburg Temple and had gone to that temple, had seen its liturgy and its ritual. But he came to the United States and was the assistant minister at Sherith Israel from 1832 to 1836. Now, Sherith Israel is a good Orthodox shul. Of course, it's not a very pious community, but it's on the books an Orthodox house of worship.
But it's
Sfard. Okay, fine. And so Poznanski learns the Sephardic ritual, and he's proficient in it, and he has a good voice. He's a musician. Then, 1836, Charleston is looking for someone to hire, and Isaac Leeser, the minister at Mikveh Israel in Philadelphia and the leader of traditional Jews in America at that time, suggests Poznanski to the community in Charleston. It's a good idea. Hire this fellow. You have my letter of recommendation. Why? Because Poznanski was seen as a religious man, a frum guy. He refused to partake of food at a certain banquet on the suspicion that it wasn't sufficiently glad kosher. All right, so he had a reputation for personal piety, which is something that these kihilot were looking for, because a lot of times their chazanim were oisvarfs. I mean, they were bad guys, but not upstanding citizens. Okay, so they hired him. In 1838, the shul burns down. So you need to build a new building. The building of a new structure is often, if not always, a reason to have a fight over doctrinal matters, since you could build it one way or you could build it another way.
Like the mechitza?
Like the mechitza, like a balcony, an organ. Do you install an organ? Do you not install an organ? Where do you place the bima, in the front or in the middle? All these questions emerge when you're rebuilding the building. So Poznanski, in 1839, already hints at a reformist tendency. Where does he get it from? I mean, I thought he was a pietist who was scrupulously kosher. The answer is people change. The few years in Charleston from 1836 to 1839 changed the man. And he now was putting out feelers for change. In 1841, the new synagogue is inaugurated, okay, and it has an organ. And Poznanski gave his approval for the use of the organ. So he, in violation of the halacha, of strict halacha, he's going to allow for the organ.
Was he in lieu of a rabbi?
He was in lieu of a rabbi, yeah.
He himself is a minister?
He's a chazan. He knows very little, yeah.
How many congregants would they lose all of a sudden as an organ? People
So a breakaway forms that goes by the name of Sherith Israel, the remnant of Israel, because they are the remnant, the pious remnant of the community of Charleston, which has now gone in the direction of heresy, of irreligion. But that community was small compared to Beit Elohim. The Orthodox in Charleston were never a big kehila. It was always a reform-dominated town ever since Beit Elohim turned the direction of reform. So they established the shul, the new building. Big celebration. 1843, Poznansky decides, you know what I want to do? I want to abolish the second day of Yom Tov. So that leads to a legal fight. For 3 years, from 1843 to 1846, they're battling it out in the courts, in the secular courts, American courts, in the state of South Carolina, over the fate of the second day of Yom Tov. This is something we saw in the European context, occasional resorting to secular authorities to resolve disputes. But in America, you wouldn't have figured this sort of thing would happen. If you don't like what's going on, so break away and form your own shul. And some people did. But others are not interested in losing their shul, Beit Elohim. They want to have their shul, but their way. In the end, the second day of Yom Tov was abolished, and Poznansky got his wishes. Now, why did he want the organ? He wanted the organ, as I say, he was a musician. And there are better selections available if you have a choir and an organ than if you have just one man singing. And so, he got his wishes. There was a choir and an organ. Yeah, question. Okay.
There is a balcony,
yes. But over time, that balcony ceased to be a women's balcony. It simply was extra seats. And there was mixed seating, eventually. Okay. So this experiment in reform, the Charleston experiment in reform, as it is known, should not be seen as part of a broad movement of reform Judaism the world over. It's specific to Charleston. These were people who were becoming increasingly Americanized. And they wanted a type of house of worship that would make them proud. Proud as Americans and proud as Jews. And the old world synagogue wouldn't do it for them. Now, there is a statement made by Poznansky at the dedication in 1841 that has been misinterpreted, in my view, over the years.
Let me read it for you.
Were they slave
holders? Some of them might have been. Yes. Most not, but some yes. Some yes.
The rabbis
used to preach self-slavery. Well, they... Yes.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, but they weren't plantation owners.
No, most were not plantation owners. Most of them who did own slaves had one or two just for a general store.
Sure,
yeah. Yes, okay. So, at the 1841 dedication, Poznansky said the following: "This synagogue is our temple. This city, our Jerusalem. This happy land, our Palestine. And as our fathers defended with their lives that temple, that city, and that land, so will their sons defend this temple, this city, and this land." So some interpreted this to mean that, like the reformers of Germany, who said Berlin is the new Jerusalem, that Poznansky is saying Charleston is the new Jerusalem. And at face value, maybe that's what he's saying, but he didn't mean it in the same way. He was not rejecting Shivat Zion, Binyan Beit HaMikdash, Kibbutz Galuyot. This was not an attempt to rid modern Judaism of all the old doctrines. It was simply a way of impressing the Goyim that we are patriotic citizens. And we take our citizenship in South Carolina and in Charleston seriously, and we're just as much a local resident and citizen as you are. So this is not really non-ideological. It's just rhetoric. It's over-the-top rhetoric.
So, but why would these people not try to get bona fide rabbis to come to the issue?
They don't want one. How do I know they don't want one? So the answer is because when rabbis actually show up, they are dismissed, or their rulings are disregarded. Next week we're going to spend a lot of time on this, on the first rabbis, and what was the fate of the first rabbis. Abraham Rice, Max Lilienthal, Isaac Meir Wise, who is not really a rabbi, is a charlatan, and a few others. They were not well treated in the beginning.
Look what happened to Rabbi Jacob Joseph.
Well, that's later, but the same thing happens. Okay, so in the few minutes we have left, I want to mention one other point. Posnansky in South Carolina said the following: "We believe that the Messiah announced by the prophets is not come, the prophecies in relation to his coming not being fulfilled." So this was his version of the Maimonidean Creed, which again is not an assertion of affirmative belief in the Messiah. It's simply a rejection that a Messiah has already arrived. So what is American Judaism in its revised form? It's non-Christianity. Non-Christianity.
Pure monotheism.
Maybe.
Yeah, but there's no messianic aspect.
Now, the other factor is, in Germany, you had Reform thinkers who believed that Judaism had a role to play in the development of human civilization, and that the arc of history is moving towards progress, getting rid of the old bigotries and hatreds and ill will between groups, to a day of universal human brotherhood in the worship of the one true God. German reformers believed that a watered-down Judaism that emphasized universal human brotherhood could one day be the religion of enlightened Europe. Did they really think that? They might have said it, but it was hard to fathom it because the hatred is too strong. It was pie in the sky. These people are not even emancipated citizens yet, and they're thinking that their religion is going to be the religion of humanity? Absurd. In America, people really did believe it. They thought, at least some of the early reform types, that a revised Judaism that got rid of some of the old world elements and was palatable to modern taste could become a dominant religion in the United States and play a very significant role in the spiritual fate of America.
But how could you fight Jesus?
You can't. It's hard to fight Jesus. The character of Jesus is almost impossible to overcome. Only the Unitarians overcame it.
So how can you think you're going to be able to make an enlightened religion?
Okay, so ultimately these hopes are also pie in the sky and don't come to pass. But the difference between Europe and America is that eventually, by the 20th century, you do have Judaism being one of the three religions of the United States. Protestant, Catholic, Jew. 1953, Will Herberg. Okay, Protestant, Catholic, Jew, those are the three pillars of American religion. In Europe, is Judaism a pillar of public religion? No, the Jews are kicked to the curb. But in America, it's not the case. So Judeo-Christian civilization, you don't hear that in Europe, you hear it here. Whether it's true or it's a myth, the point is at least people say it. So the early reformers were on target in thinking we could contribute to the spiritual growth of the United States. Okay, we'll stop here.